All right, we're in 1 Peter chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. We started into at least the beginning of our study of verse 6 a couple weeks ago. Last week, we took a step back to look at really the big picture of what this subject is about. 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7 is going to be very much on the subject of spiritual growth. And even though he doesn't use the word grow or growth in those two verses, we should be able to understand as we study through that that is certainly what he's describing, as well as one of the major ways that our spiritual growth is accomplished. So last week, we stepped back a bit, looked at the big picture of what spiritual growth is, to understand a little better, remind ourselves, refresh our minds about what spiritual growth actually is. And as we saw then, it's this process of our purging out the things that are in our inner man, in our hearts, that are not parts of God's nature, of his love, and then the building in our hearts of all of those parts of his love, with the goal of being spiritually complete, with all of the things that don't work as righteousness purged out, and all of the parts of his love in us. So that's the overall goal that we have, to be conformed to the image of Christ, and that's what his image is. It is that complete love. And then to grow in all of those things, which is our goal. And it's a complicated subject. I mean, as we're trying to understand the very heart of God himself, I mean, that is not something that is light or easy. We spend a lifetime studying and learning more about God, understanding him, knowing him better, and understanding the different parts of his nature better, and understanding what's in us and what we need to grow in. And so all of that is very deep and requires a lot of study over a lifetime. And the different things that God teaches us of how we grow in these different things, different parts of his nature, that's also a very complex and deep subject. It's not just one thing. And we can go read the book of Proverbs and study about the pathway of understanding and wisdom. And every good path, as he mentions there, and the pathways of righteousness and judgment and equity. I mean, there's so many different good pathways, things that we need to understand, things that we need to put into practice so that we can grow more in some very specific things. So we have to study all of God's word to find those things. He does tell us about a lot of our spiritual growth that comes from our putting into practice, as he uses the term exercise in the New Testament a number of times, such as in Hebrews chapter 5 and in verse 13 or 14, where he says, "Strong meat belongs to them that are of full age," which is the Greek word teleos for complete. So he's describing the characteristics of those who are spiritually complete in God's love. And he says, "Even those who by reason of use have their senses exercised to discern both good and evil." Are we going to be able to be spiritually complete without exercising our senses to discern both good and evil? So there's spiritual exercise that we have to engage in of our senses to discern both good and evil. 1 Timothy chapter 4 and verse 7 tells us to exercise ourselves rather unto godliness. And we read last week 1 John 4:12 that says if we love one another, then God's love is perfected in us. So we have a lot of scriptures that teach us the importance and necessity of putting into practice the different aspects of God's nature to be able to grow more in those things, to exercise ourselves in those things. So we have to exhibit or demonstrate, show kindness to one another and mercy and gentleness and meekness and all of these things that are part of the heart of Christ and of our Heavenly Father. And there has to be a need that others have, especially our brethren, for certain things, and then us to fulfill those needs and actually demonstrate those, and that gives us an opportunity to grow more in them. But another very important pathway of our spiritual growth is that of suffering for righteousness' sake. And that is the particular pathway that he's describing here in 1 Peter 1, verses 6 and 7. And as we've mentioned before, this same topic is very central to the teachings, the overall teachings in this book of 1 Peter, and it's in every single chapter, all five chapters of the book. And so here's our introduction to it in chapter 1, verses 6 and 7. So we want to read that again now. He says, "Wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you are in heaviness through manifold temptations, that the trial of your faith, being much more precious than of gold that perisheth, though it be tried with fire, might be found unto praise and honor and glory at the appearing of Jesus Christ." So when he's talking about us and what is in us, when Christ appears and then we appear before him on that day of judgment, what do we want to be? What do we want to be found to be like? And what kind of faith do we want to have? What do we want the Lord to have or be able to see in us as far as what our inner man is like? As we know that this is all talking about what's going to be in our inner man, not the physical part of us, but that spiritual part of us that goes on to eternity. So when we are judged by him, we want our faith to be found to unto praise and honor and glory. Well, is that exactly where we are right now? Is he speaking about us in terms of already being at that point of what our goal is that he's describing there, and what we desire to be like, what he desires us to be like? Are we there yet? You know, our kids always asked us that when they were little on the trips that we would take them on. Are we there yet? Well, spiritually, are we there yet? No. So here we are at a certain point, and here's where we need to be. And he says, here's how you get there. Well, what do you describe that when you go from, when you improve from a certain point to another point? I mean, that is describing growth, isn't it? Here he's doing it in terms of, or using the analogy of the purification of gold. And how is gold and precious metals, how are they purified? I mean, there are different degrees or grades of the purity of precious metals, aren't there? For any of those precious metals to be of a higher level of purity, how does that occur? That has to be. The impurities have to be burned out. That's what happens. That's the analogy he's using concerning what is taking place in us. The impurities have to be burned out of us. Does that sound like a pleasant process, an entirely pleasant process? There's a way for us to look at it and understand it as we're going through it, where we we can rejoice in it while at the same time, what does he say in verse 6? What's that word that he uses when we are going through these manifold temptations? He says heaviness. So he says that we, wherein you greatly rejoice, though now for a season, if need be, you're in heaviness. Can you rejoice while you're having heaviness at the same time? Obviously so. He's teaching us to do that. Does that come naturally, or is that something that we do need to learn as we grow in our understanding and wisdom? We remember Philippians 4 and verse 11, where the Apostle Paul said that he had learned in whatsoever state he was in therewith to be content. He said, I know both how to abound and to be abased. And well, when you're abased and you're suffering lack in some way, you're going through a hard time, does contentment in that state, does that just naturally come? Is that the way we respond to it? Well, there's a reason why Brother Johnson Sunday morning was bringing a lesson, and there are many scriptures that he presented, and there are lots of them, Old and New Testaments, about our not murmuring and complaining. Because when things, when we're having difficulties in our lives and things aren't going particularly well in some way, some area where we are lacking something, we're facing some kind of hardship, what is the, in fact, the text he started from was that same book of Philippians in chapter 2. And so in chapter 4, the Apostle Paul had learned in whatsoever state he was in therewith to be content. But isn't it very easy just to start griping, complaining, moaning if something doesn't go our way? That's very easy to do. What about being content in our low circumstances as well as when we're abounding, when everything is going like we would like for it to? We have to learn that, we have to learn to be able to rejoice when we're having manifold temptations. That isn't our natural state. So that's something we have to work at that, to learn that. And he's teaching us to do that here. We did start into verse 6 where he says, wherein you greatly rejoice. And just to review very briefly from a couple of weeks ago when we were looking at that particular word and agalion is the number 5 or 621 in the Strong's dictionary. That's the word for greatly rejoice. So it is a compound word in Greek, as it is two separate words in the translation here. And we noted it's literally means to jump for joy. It's a word that is really on a different level than what is the standard word, that the most common word that we read in Scripture for joy. We have a lot of passages in the New Testament, like we have in Philippians 4 and verse 4. Or three in chapter 3 and verse 1, where he tells us to rejoice in the Lord, or rejoice in the Lord always. And again, I say rejoice. When he tells us that, I mean, he's using the word kara, which is the word for joy or rejoice. This particular word is a very strong word, as the meaning would. The definition should tell us, but to jump for joy. And so he says, greatly rejoice. So he's not talking here even about our learning how to, well, I've got a little joy in this. I can see some point to this misery I'm in. No, he says we can learn and should, with good understanding, be able to jump for joy. in a spiritual way, of course. Though now for a season, he says, we are in heaviness through manifold temptations. Now, that just, reading that, it doesn't sound natural for us, does it? To jump for joy, look at all these temptations I'm under, and then just be thrilled with it. Well, it doesn't mean that the temptations themselves somehow convey some pleasurable feeling to us. It is something that does put us under heaviness, but we can greatly rejoice, jump for joy, spiritually, with proper understanding of what all of this is for, and that's what he's teaching us. And so he's not just telling us, okay, you're going to have a lot of temptations, and you have to bear up under those and be happy about it. He tells us why. In fact, the book that we studied most recently told us, the one before this one, when we were studying the book of James, he also taught us this same point in James 1, verses 2 through 4. James 1, 2 through 4, where he says, my brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience, but let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing. So we see that same goal that we were looking at in our overview last week, for us spiritually to be complete and entire, lacking nothing. We don't want to be lacking in any of what's in the heart of Christ. We want to be complete and entire in all of that, lacking nothing. How does that happen? Well, that's going to be part of the work of patience, and that is the complete work of patience to produce that outcome. Well, how do we grow in patience, which is that word for endurance? Now, some of the things that, some of the parts of God's love, we grow in through that spiritual exercise in practicing those things that as God commands us to do. There are certain things that will require, do we have to have one of our brethren doing something evil to us in order to show kindness to them? No, we don't have to have that. Now, do we still have to exhibit kindness if they have some need, even if they're mistreating us? Yes. So it's not to say, that doesn't say that if we are suffering for righteousness' sake, that we can't or shouldn't be able to put into practice all of these things that are of God's nature. But some of them don't require somebody to do something evil to us in order for us to practice it. But there are certain things that that we have to grow in that we can't grow in without going through spiritual trials on our faith. How can we grow in endurance without having something to endure? And that's one of the things he teaches there in James 1 in verses 2 and 3. Particularly verse 3, where he says, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience. So now we tend to think maybe on that patience means that we can, we a lot of times we think of that more like what the word long-suffering means, when we are very long and suffering, when we have to wait for something, for somebody for a long time. That is more in the realm of what long suffering is. The word patience actually is endurance. If we want to be able to endure more spiritually, how is that going to happen? Well, we have to show kindness to grow in kindness. We have to exhibit endurance to grow in endurance. And what situation will make us have to exhibit endurance? When our faith is being tried. But when he tells us there in verse 2 to count it all joy when we fall into divers temptations, he says, knowing this. So to be able to count it all joy, or as he puts it in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, to greatly rejoice in it, are we going to be able to do that if we don't know and understand what the trials are for? We won't. So it's essential for us to be able to know and understand the reason and the pathway that he's describing for us and how this happens and what it produces. When we know and understand that, then when we're going through it, we can count it all joy and greatly rejoice when we're going through it, knowing what it is for and what it's producing for us. Now, in James 1, 2 through 4, the focus is on knowing what the trials are producing in us, and then what that's going to lead to in terms of our being able to reach the goal that we do have with our spiritual growth, to be conformed to the image of Christ, that is, to be complete and entire, lacking nothing spiritually. But that comes through, the endurance comes through the trials on our faith. In 1 Peter chapter 1 and verse 6, similarly, he says, wherein we greatly rejoice through manifold temptations. So there's a word that he's using there. Now, in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, we've seen the word for greatly rejoice, so wherein you greatly rejoice. And when he says, though now for a season, we also, a couple of weeks ago when we were studying that, we mentioned that particular word, that allagos is the Greek word there for season. The word literally means puny. So as far as the period of time that we're going to have to go through the trials on our faith, even though when we're going through some things at certain times, we might feel like it's never ending, but it isn't never ending. The time that we're going to be going through a particular trial on our faith, especially compared with what it is producing and how long that is going to last. I mean, how long does the benefit or the growth, the spiritual growth that is produced from the trials on our faith, how long does that last? If we are steadfast and unmovable and continue to endure and overcome the temptations, then how long does the spiritual growth that it produces, how long does that last? How long does a heart last? I mean, it's eternity. These are the unseen things that we're looking at here. These are the eternal things. So this lasts. And that's what he's speaking about there in verse 7, about how we will then be at the appearing of our Lord Jesus Christ, what we're going to be like then. Now, for us to be like that at his appearing, are we going to be like that? In order to be like that at his appearing, are we going to have to be like that when we leave this earth? Yes. But then what does that tell us about when we leave this earth with those things, when we've grown in our being partakers of the divine nature, and we have his love completed in us, when our heart has been purified and we've been formed in his image, then how long does that last? That's eternal. Unless we turn away, turn back before and give in to the temptations, which is why we're having such great encouragement not to do that. But if we do endure, then what this is going to produce is going to be eternal. If we have the heart of Christ when we leave this earth, we take that beyond. And when we are on the day of judgment, then that's who we'll be then. And then when we are with him in eternity, that's who we are then. That's who we'll be. That's the heart we take and have forever and ever. So that is very encouraging, and that's really the emphasis on the counting it all joy in James 1, 2 through 4. our understanding, knowing what this is producing now, which, I mean, that's actually happening as we go through the trial. So it's not like this is all deferred reward. Now, the ultimate reward in heaven that he's most definitely speaking about here in the early part of chapter 1 of 1 Peter, at his appearing, and as we were reading in verses 3 through 5, that incorruptible inheritance that is reserved in heaven for us, and as he actually goes on all the way to verse 9 concerning the salvation of our souls. So, yes, the ultimate reward that we're going to have in heaven, I mean, that is deferred until we get there. So we do have to wait for his appearing in the end, when this world ends, and then judgment day occurs, and then we'll be given that inheritance. So yes, the eternal reward is to come later, but becoming more like Christ is occurring right now as we go through each of those trials and endure. So that is something to be joyful about. If we're more like Christ today than we were yesterday, is that not something to count all joy over? That is. But then also knowing that he's going to give us an eternal reward for it. So that's the emphasis here in 1 Peter 1. Does that also help us to greatly rejoice when we have those trials in our faith? Yes. So he gives us all the reasons there for in understanding what this is for, so that we can greatly rejoice. But he's also, of course, showing us what the purpose is that we are going through right now in verses 6 and 7 here in 1 Peter 1, when he compares it to the purifying of gold in the fire as our faith is being tried. So that's happening now. So we're becoming... We're a pure grade of gold spiritually, hopefully, today than we were yesterday or whenever the last trial that we were starting to go through. But those trials compared to that eternal reward and what having the heart of Christ and that being something eternal in duration, the trial, that this period, whatever trial we're having to go through to grow more in that and to have our faith purified more, it's puny, and that's the word he uses. It's puny in comparison to that. When we think of, in the book of James, really very near the end of the book, brought up a certain one who is the prophets are an example that we're to take in suffering affliction and of endurance, as we were reading about that in James chapter 5 and verse 10. But which specific example did he bring up in James 5:11? One that when we think about somebody who suffered and was in heaviness through manifold temptations, through suffering for righteousness' sake, I mean, what particular individual comes to our mind probably first and foremost in that, where we have an entire book about it? Job. And even though when we read the book of Job, and as it starts with chapter 1, when he loses all of his children die, and he loses all of his worldly possessions, and then in chapter 2, when his health is taken and he's smitten with sore boils from head to foot. Those first two chapters go through the process of how this affliction occurs and the process there. But we don't have anything that just says it. And on this date, this happened to Job, and then this went through this long, and here's the date when it finally came to an end. We don't have something that spells it out quite like that, but we do have statements in the book of Job where he describes what's going on with him and the physical changes that he went through when he was when he sat down there in those in the ashes with those sore boils. I mean, in that book, he describes changes in his skin, changes in his body, and weight loss, and so we might tend to think, okay, Job gets smitten with boils. The next day, his friends show up and start condemning him, and then they sat there for a week and didn't speak, and then they started condemning him. So we might get the idea, okay, well, this is a week goes by, and then a few more days, and then it finally all ends for him. And no. He even refers to months in the book that he's going through those things. So there was a trial, that trial on his faith when, he was in that physical condition. This was going on for months. And how much did he pray over the course of that time? How many times did he pray that the Lord would take that physical misery away from him? You think he took a day off from asking that? He refers in the book to not being heard. This is going on for months, and day after day through all this misery, he'd be pleading with the Lord, and he's not getting his request. Is he questioning whether God's hearing him and going to respond to that? And this all becomes part of those trials that he was going through there. Wasn't the Lord's will at that time that the Lord knew what he could endure, and it was a lot. But in any event, just considering that and that example there, and that went on for months, but how much was that compared to, Job would have lived in the time of the book of Genesis. He passed away a long time ago. How long has he been in paradise? For thousands of years. And we know what's to come for him as far as the judgment and his eternity. And question, as long as that lasted for him there, what was it compared to his eternity? Even that was puny, wasn't it? It was. So he's using that word and describing the time of these trials. So even though from our perspective it might seem like something is just going on and on and on, and that with it, it won't relent. But no, the Lord tells us that it's for a season. The Lord knows what we can bear. And he's not going to allow us to be put through anything that's beyond what we can bear up under at any particular time. We have that promise from him in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. Verse 12 says, "Wherefore let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall." And then verse 13 says, "There hath no temptation taken you but such as is common to man." Now that's another thing, as we tend to get, it's easy to get on the doom and gloom pathway as far as looking at what we're going through, and nobody's ever suffered like I have, and we can throw ourselves a really wonderful pity party and going through something and whine about it. And what is he telling us there, though? Is there anything that we're going through that is especially designed just for us, and nobody that's ever lived has ever been through anything like what we're going through? No, even if we try to think like that, he's telling us that's not the way it is. So there's no temptation taken you but such as is common to man, he says. But God is faithful, who will not suffer you, and that's allow. He will not allow you to be tempted above that you are able, but will with the temptation also make a way to escape that you may be able to bear it. And I know we pointed it out before, but what we're able to bear, like what we can bear right now at this moment, is it exactly the same as what we were able to bear a few months or years ago. It shouldn't be the same. And what we'll be able to bear in the future should be different than what we can bear right now. It's not a static thing that doesn't change. What our capacity to endure changes because we grow in patience through those trials on our faith. So he tells us that's what is happening as we go through each one of them, so we can bear more. And then we're thinking, oh great, now I can endure more, so that means the trial next time is going to be bigger. Well, yeah, but it's still puny. And so we can still greatly rejoice knowing, well, we're going to get more pure. We're going to grow more in the image of Christ. This is one of the major pathways. And we have many things in our hearts that do not work the righteousness of God. Those spiritual impurities. Does he really describe any other way those things are going to get purged out without being burned out through these trials? So we grow more in endurance and it's removing the impurities. Well, do you want your impurities removed? do you want those things out of your heart? Well, I want them out of mine. I just want it without the trials, but that doesn't happen, does it? So, and that's what we have to understand. But when we recognize, okay, this is how I'm going to get more of those things that are in me that I don't like, the Lord doesn't like, because this is not Him, and more of that's going to get purged out here through this. Well, can we rejoice at that? We should greatly, and the season or time for it, for the trial, is puny. And he says, if need be, if necessary, literally is what the word means. Why does he say that? Well, this is another reminder that each trial is puny. It's for a season, and then it's over. Well, is our life as a Christian, is it nothing except for an endless trial in our faith from start to finish? No. There is each trial lasts for a certain amount of time. It's still for a season. It's still puny, to keep it in perspective. Some trials are going to be greater than others, and particularly over time as we're able to endure more, we can expect that. But it's not that we have to be going through that nonstop. That's not the way that it works. And does the Lord, does He give us a respite from our trials if we've come through it and endured? Well, what did He tell us again in the last book, in James chapter 4? What did He tell us there in verse 7 of James 4, when He says, "Submit yourselves therefore to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you." Well, when are we being tempted by the devil? Well, that's when we're going through the trials. If we overcome, I mean, what's the difference between overcoming the temptation and resisting the devil? I mean, that's what it is. Now, is that success or failure when we've overcome and resisted? That's success. That's winning the battle. So each trial is going to bring, and does each trial bring one temptation? No, a particular trial can bring a lot of temptations. We just read that in James chapter 1 and in verse 2 when he says, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations." And then here in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, he says, "You're in heaviness through manifold temptations." And that's actually the same word. Poikilos is the Greek word for that, for manifold. Literally means motley. It's diverse. There are a lot of them. So there's going to be a lot of temptations that we'll go through in a particular trial in our faith. I mean, how many different things was Job tempted to do when he was going through what he was going through? I mean, his wife told him to curse God. He was being... Was there any temptation to quit? Was there any temptation to revile those friends of his that were condemning him wrongly and to do evil to them? I mean, think about all those different temptations he was going through those trials. It's more than one thing. How many different things was Jesus tempted in when in his sufferings at his death, through the all those trials, through that night, and then with all that took place the following morning and the day and his crucifixion? I mean, how many different things did the devil come after him on through all of that? I mean, we couldn't put a number on it, but many different things there. That's what happens in our trials. But when we do resist, what happens? What is the promise? Well, the devil will flee from us. Well, does he return? Yes, we have to have more trials. But what happens after a trial is over, and if we've endured, we've resisted the devil and overcome those temptations, we've grown more, does the Lord give us a respite between that and whenever the next trial may be? Yes, he does. Does that mean it's going to be years? No, but whatever it is we need. So that's we can see that there when he says, if need be, if necessary. There are going to be times where it's going to be necessary. There'll be other times when it's not. But when the Lord grants Satan the opportunity to put us through a trial like he did with Job, then the Lord considers that necessary, which means it is. That's the word there, if need be, if necessary. Was it necessary for Job to go through all that? It was. And who brought Job up when in that conversation between Satan and God in both chapter 1 and chapter 2 in Job? Have you considered my servant Job? That's what God said to Satan. Well, he very much had considered Job, but God was the one bringing it up. And then Satan responded with his complaint that he couldn't get at him. And then who removed the fence, or at least not entirely removed it, but removed its boundaries around him? Well, the Lord did. But whose idea was that? Who was the one that initiated what was to come there upon Job, that trial? God considered that necessary. So now prior to that, the devil had the desire to do these things and more. But had God considered it necessary for Job to go through that prior to then? No. But that was the right time for Job. And so God gave him that particular trial to go through then, because that's when it was necessary. And actually, Job understood that, and he understood that was what God was doing and what he had determined. And he actually, in Job chapter 23, we can see that Job understood the reason for his trial. Let's see if it sounds anything like 1 Peter 1, 6 and 7. So he says in verse 10, Job 23, verse 10, he says, "But he knoweth the way that I take. When he hath tried me, I shall come forth as gold." Did Job understand the pathway and its purpose? Now, his friends didn't. His friends didn't understand that. His friends wrongly concluded that, well, anything bad that happens to you, that means you must have done something wicked, because if you're righteous, nothing bad is going to happen to you. It's very difficult for me to believe that nothing bad had ever happened to any of his friends in their lives. So had they considered that. Well, they don't seem to have been considering that while they were condemning Job. But Job understood what this was for. He understood why. Did it make sense to Job in his understanding? Did it make sense that he would have to go through trials on his faith even when he had done no wrong? Do you see Job saying, well, why would, if I've done right, why should I have to suffer at all? You don't see that. Now, do we see his pleas with the heaviness he was having and for relief? And then even begging his friends to give him comfort and not adding to it with their condemnation. But he understood what this was for. And so he said that God knows the way that Job was taking, and he says, and when he's tried me, I will come forth as gold. So he knew what that was doing for him spiritually. Did he also know that this trial would pass at some point, but there would be more to come in his future if he survived this? Now, that was something he questioned. He didn't know with what was going on with his physical decline and all that misery. It's very plain from many of his words in there that that he very well contemplated that he may not have physically survived this situation. But whatever he was going through, he understood the purpose. And in verse 11, Job 23:11, he says, my foot hath held his steps, his way have I kept and not declined, neither have I gone back from the commandment of his lips. I have esteemed the words of his mouth more than my necessary food. But he is in one mind, and who can turn him? And what his soul desireth, even that he doeth. He's talking about determining that it was necessary for him to go through these trials, even though he had been doing what was right. Same thing for us, isn't it? Is God of one mind? And if he determines it's necessary now for us to go through a trial, who can turn him? If he knows that's what we need spiritually, and he's working in us, who can turn him? Can we say, God, help me to be able to be like you, but through some other way than the way that you said is necessary for it to happen? I mean, that would be a vain prayer. He tells us how it's got to happen. And if his soul desires that he work in us and help us to grow more through a trial, then he's going to do that. That's verse 13. And then verse 14, he says, for he performeth the thing that is appointed for me, and many such things are with him. Therefore am I troubled at his presence when I consider. I am afraid of him. Now, and we can do that if we start thinking about if God gives us life. I mean, what could we be going through next year? Next week, next month, next year, tomorrow, whatever, years down the road. I mean, we don't know. When we think about, and we'll be able to endure more, if we think about it with understanding, are there likely some great trials ahead of us in our future? Yes, and when we start to think of that, can that start making us maybe a little bit afraid of tomorrow? Yeah, and Job was experiencing that, especially as he was going through what he was going through. So is that a track we want to stay on? I mean, we understand what the point and purpose of these things are. We have to get through this trial and overcome these temptations and resist him and trust him. He's going to do what is work it for our good. He's not going to allow us to be tempted above what we can bear, and so we have to trust him, and he's going to be very good to us through all of that, and we have to go through that. That's what this life is for. But these things will be puny in comparison to what it's producing and for how long. And then when we think about what it is producing, then we can greatly rejoice in it anyway. Now, is there a reason why the Lord hasn't told us everything that's going to happen to us in the future? that'd be kind of hard to get out of bed on a day. If you knew that you were something really awful was going to happen to you that day, that some really major trial was going to start occurring, how tempting would it be just to throw the covers over your head and not get up that day? It would be hard to get up and go face it knowing, okay, this is what God says is going to happen to you today, and you've got to go through that. Now go do it. That would be hard. Now think about what Christ did, especially in his death. He knew everything that was coming. And he steadfastly set his face to go to Jerusalem, heading down there, knowing full well, and he talked to his apostles about it. It gave him trouble. It did trouble him, and that's where this word heaviness, we can see some how that heaviness he speaks about was something that Christ had to go through. So when it was necessary for him to be to go through trials, the difference for him was he wasn't just thinking of it in the abstract. Well, I know there's going to be trials to come. He knew what the big trial was and knew exactly what was going to happen to him because it was all laid out and foretold by the prophets, and he understood what was going to happen there. He even told his disciples what was going to happen there, and he still went and did it. That is very difficult for me to comprehend, that kind of strength and courage to go through and face with full advanced knowledge of all that was going to happen there. But that was him, and that's what he did. So he set the example for us. We got to walk in his steps, and it's going to be through a lot of trials. And those trials do bring heaviness. That word, by the way, luteo is the Greek word, 3076, if you want that Strong's number. But it means to distress or to be sad. So whether it's active or passive, of course, in this case, it's happening to us. And by the way, it's some people are described in that way. Interestingly, Matthew 14:9, Herod was very sorry when, by his own foolishness, he was trapped by his promise to his daughter-in-law Herodias, whose mother had instructed her to ask for the head of John the Baptist. And then when he was put in that situation, then Herod was very sorry, it says. He had heaviness, sadness, or distress for that situation. Well, that was completely self-induced. Out of his own wickedness with who he was with, that he had no right to be with, and all of that. But when we see Christ, as we were mentioning, he went through all the temptations that he did in the trials on his faith, and it gave him heaviness. It gave him distress. So let's look for a moment at Matthew chapter 26, verses 37 and 38, as we're out of time. But Matthew 26, 37 and 38, it says, "And he took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee, and began to be sorrowful and very heavy. Then saith he unto them, My soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me." That was in the Garden of Gethsemane. Again, he knew what was coming. He knew they were coming to get him. Judas knew where Christ would go, and he knew where he would be. And so that's why he was going to be able to lead them there at night to get him. Well, he knows that Judas knows that. He knows that they're going to be coming to get him. He knows that Judas has betrayed him. He knows the amount that he betrayed him for. He knows all of that. If we knew that, wouldn't that be the last place on this earth, literally, that we'd want to be at that moment in time, knowing what was going to happen there and what it was going to lead to? But he went there. But knowing what he was, the trial that was beginning there, I mean, really had already begun as he had been betrayed by one of his own. But when he took Peter and James and John there into the garden with him, he was very heavy and said that his soul was exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. And that's the same word that's there in 1 Peter 1 and verse 6, translated heaviness. One other passage that we'll squeeze in here in this last moment, but 2 Corinthians chapter 6, and then we'll have to call it quits for tonight and, Lord willing, resume here next week. But 2 Corinthians chapter 6, the Apostle Paul, and recounting his trials and the things that he had gone through in his service to Christ. And he mentions in verse 5, for example, the stripes and imprisonments and tumults and labors, watchings and fastings. And then we get down to verse 10. He says, as sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, as poor, yet making many rich, as having nothing and yet possessing all things. But notice he says, as sorrowful, and that's that same word as heaviness, yet always rejoicing. So did he count it all joy, and was Paul rejoicing even though he was sorrowful in heaviness through his manifold temptations? He was doing that. And we can too, and we have to follow Paul as he followed Christ. So yes, it will be necessary for us to go through these trials. They will be puny, but they're going to bring us heaviness, but we can greatly rejoice in even through the distress that it brings to us, whatever that circumstance or that trial is. Lord willing, we will resume our study there in 1 Peter 1, 6, and 7 next Wednesday night. Appreciate everybody being here this evening.